Good afternoon and welcome to the final panel session for the Melbourne University Festival of Ideas, Climate Change, Cultural Change. It's been a terrific week of events and far wiser heads than mine talking on a range of topics. Today's panel brings together four of Australia's best and best-loved novelists to talk about the role of the novel in the time of change. And I'll introduce them just from nearest to me and along, Shane Maloney, Kate Grenville, Steve Carroll and Sonia Hartnett. Please give them a big, warm round of applause. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. We are on the land of the Wurundjeri people, and I'd like to pay my respect to their elders, both past and present. I'd also like to acknowledge the Vice-Chancellor, who is here either because he has to be or because he's really enjoying the festival so far. No one's quite clear, but his attendance is surprising 6 days in. Nice work there. And I'm sure many of you... have seen a number of things over the course of the past week. I was also asked to acknowledge alumni of this university, of which I am one. I was something of an indifferent student, but I learned many, many things when I was at university. But I can't help but come away with the fact that it was the extracurricular activities that kind of marked me. Most of all, I was involved in student activism at this university, and many of my friends went on to work in far worthier fields than myself. They went to work in social work, they went to work in the NGO sector. And when we talk about our political beliefs now, I say, well, I work in publishing. I believe in the novel, the power of the novel. And then I have to buy them a drink and kind of justify my position at length. And that is a little bit what we're going to have today. Now, it's going to be a very informal chat between the five of us. But to kick things off, Shane Maloney is going to read something to you all. Now, Shane's latest book, Sucked In, was the sixth Murray Whelan book, and if you haven't read them, they are wonderful, wonderful comic novels. Sucked In is a parable about the unlikelihood of clean coal and the way in which through powerful metaphor he tells the story that clean coal is a false trail to follow, and it's a searing indictment of political opportunism. So please make welcome Shane Maloney.
Thank you for that, Michael. I'm very pleased to be here. My book is, of course, about absolutely nothing like that. the other novelists here have elected to read from their work, but I've decided to take mercy on you and spare you that ordeal. If you'd like to read my book, and I do urge it upon you, buy it, you cheapskates. but I would like to begin the formal proceedings here by acknowledging the traditional owners of the place in which we're gathered, in this case the Victorian Association of Greater Public Schools. in particular, I'd like to thank Melbourne, Kerry and Geelong Grammars, Halebury, Xavier and Wesley for allowing us to use their alumni facilities here today at Melbourne, the University of Melbourne Grammar. Is there anyone here from the University English Department, by the way? One person? Two people. Everyone else, I assume, is off at the Interspatiality Jane Austen Desire and Climate Change seminar. but it's good to see that a couple of members of, presumably junior members of the English department, have popped along to see some live writers here today, and Australians at that. while I'm delighted that Patrick McKackie invited me to participate in this Festival of Ideas, I must confess to being somewhat at a loss when confronted with the really big questions at stake at the moment that are being addressed over these recent days, and the role of the novelist at a time like this. I can only assume that I was invited here because my particular area of writing, crime fiction, is sometimes called pulp fiction. And so in my case at least, the novel is laid bare for what it is at its most essential, 500 grams of processed forestry industry byproduct, value added by the addition of ink. And just in laying bare the simple facts of the physicality of the novel, I think also I'm laying bare my own particular dilemma about this. Trees, as we know, are essential to the production of gases that will neutralise CO2. So more people reading books equals fewer trees. More trees, less Pulp Fiction. I'd be putting myself out of work if I continue along this line. So am I part of the problem or part of the solution? Are we all? Well, that's a question that we're addressing, I think, at whatever our vocation, pursuit or profession, or indeed consumption patterns are. You've been hearing over the last few days here about the potentially catastrophic effects of climate change and our difficulties as a species in coming to grips with that very real and present danger. Of course, through the ages, artists and a variety of media have attempted to give expression to a sense of imminent doom and to warn people of the consequences of not changing their behaviour. In the distant past, in the European tradition, they portrayed a last judgment and its corollary, a hell in which the consequences of sin, pride, greed, sloth, the eternal and contemporary sins, are made manifest in lakes of bubbling poison, in which willful transgressors are condemned for all eternity. For those who repent, change their wicked ways, there are fluffy clouds and choirs of angels. Now, more recently, within our own lifetime, the possibility of human-induced cataclysm that renders the Earth uninhabitable to our species became a real possibility in the form of nuclear war. That threat, too, became a source of creative inspiration for artists. Specifically, I think, or more particularly, or more evidently, novelists and filmmakers. And the range of the approach of artists over the last 50 years to that particular threat extended from the sublime to the ridiculous, to the heights of novels such as Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker, all the way through to Planet of the Apes. In the nuclear Holocaust novel, the apocalypse itself makes only the briefest appearance, if at all. The annihilation of civilization happens in a blinding flash. The old world vanishes entirely, replaced by a tabula rasa on which the novelist can inscribe whatever he or she cares to imagine. And in this regard, in this location, I can't help but think of Neville Shute's On the Beach, a novel set right here in Melbourne about the end of the world, the perfect place, as the wags have had it ever since, in fact, to set such a story. In that novel, as a consequence of events in the Northern Hemisphere that Australians are powerless to prevent, Melbournians await their inexorable doom. It's their deportment in the face of imminent extinguishment that the novelist addresses. And climate change, by comparison, offers no blinding flash, no clear-cut before and after dichotomy for novelists and artists of all kinds to work with. The catastrophe will come in installments. What we will experience will not be the sudden disappearance of the world as we know it, but the aggravation and exacerbation and magnification of the worst elements of the current order. In the nuclear apocalypse, we all went down the gurgler together, and we knew that that was what was going to happen to us. With climate change, there are clearly many who think that they will be able to avoid the worst. Whatever happens, their importance and power will be undiminished. It may even, in fact, be enhanced. They will continue to rule from their high towers far above the rising tide, protected from climate refugees by armed guards. They will be safe in what I've come to think of as the Heather Ridout Redoubt. Can creative writers then make a difference? Can we add our shoulders and our keyboards to the urgent tasks that confront us as a species? Well, I wish I could say yes to that. But what form would or should or can our endeavours take? Should we seek to change people's behaviour through our work? to mistake our role as observers and commentators with that of propagandists. Well, I think there are two problems with this. The writing of propaganda compromises us as artists, but most importantly, it doesn't work. As a reader, the last thing I want in a novel is instruction. And I'm not alone in that sentiment. As a writer, I'm very loath to give instruction. In fact, I'm not sure how you go about it. I attempted it through satire. After six novels in which I depicted the Labor Party as a pack of rogues, I find myself in prominent place on the bookshelves of MPs. Invited to Canberra for a quick tour of Parliament House. So, what's a novelist to do then? What to write? Where can fiction or how can fiction succeed where barefaced fact is failing? Well, I think really it boils down to three options. If we accept that climate change will be here sooner rather than later, then what we should do is type faster and move our favourite books from the bottom shelf to a higher one on our bookcases. The other possibility is that we can pretend it isn't happening, in which case we can be pretty sure that we'll always be able to get a job as a columnist in the Murdoch Press. Well, thirdly, we can put aside for a moment any sense of ourselves as privileged or special because of our vocation as writers and think of ourselves primarily as citizens and human beings first, in which case we might think of doing something like voting Green at the next election, because a vote for anyone else, frankly, is a vote for the status quo. In the meantime, well, I think that the best we can do is what we always do, stare at a blank sheet of paper, summon forth the best that our minds can come up with, and try to find an effective way of communicating what's important to us to everyone else. I'll leave it at that, thanks.
I can't, is this working up the back? Excellent. I can't help but be touched by you referring to yourself as a live writer, Shane. That's very endearing. And I think, you know, you lived up to that lovely call to arms. Now, this picture of climate change descending upon us as something in installments like a Charles Dickens novel, how much do you think there's incremental change in the way writers are going to be approaching this question? Shane? Oh, you're done. Shane's done speaking. That was it. He said buy his book and he said vote Green, so he's finished.
Well, look, the incremental aspect of what is happening and what will happening is that I think as I touched on, I mean, what we're going to see, I think, in the way of responses to climate change, of what happens when, when the floods of refugees start to appear on the horizon, when attempts are made directly by people to confront the polluters and so on, is that there will be an increase in the national security state aspect of things. I think that at a political level, we're going to see many, many more sort of Black Hawk helicopters in the sky. And for me as a crime writer, of course, this presents a massive opportunity. and I'll be looking to take advantage of that. But I think in the sense that one of the roles that the novel has established for itself in its history is the confrontation of power. then we're going to have our work cut out for us there.
If not climate change, how much do the decisions you make about the subjects that you choose, how much are they informed by a contemporary political understanding of the world? Do you write about history in an attempt to write allegory?
No, I don't even think about these things at all. I mean, I'm not... Most writers I know don't think about this sort of stuff consciously at all. I mean, I'm a political person. I've got political views, and I tend to think that if you want to make a political difference, you go out and perform a political act. And that doesn't mean that writing a novel isn't a political act, but not for me. I really think a writer serves their readers, serves themselves. Writers serve themselves, their readers, and society, if you like, by just writing as well as they can and responding to the things that are urgent in them. And I think that the times you live in, and all times are times of change, you know, I mean, some more dramatically so, but I think it is a truism to say that. Times are always changing. And those times will be manifest in what you write. Like murder, it will out. In different degrees. So you don't consciously say to yourself, well, I'm living in a time of, you know, tumultuous change here, and I'll write about this. I mean, I think that's the best way to write a really crappy novel, I think. But you've actually got to work from the stuff that is vital in you, and hopefully that will be manifest in the way you write. But also, I don't know, I say I'm a political person, but at the same time, I suspect that, you know, when climate change does become obvious and you can't ignore it, I'll still be one of those walking around for a quiet, warm place to set my desk on and sit down and write that novel about 1930s society or something like that. So there's a selfishness in me, you know, that doesn't care.
Well, as one of your readers, I think I can say thank you for that selfishness. But okay, if writing isn't an inherently political act, let's leave aside the politics for a moment. Why, all four of you, why do you write? What drives you? What kind of idea makes you say, okay, there's a story I want to tell? Maybe I'll throw this to you first, Kate.
Oh, I thought it was Sonia's turn. Sonia is now wired up.
I thought Sonia had been talking the whole time.
I am so storming off. Already.
Excellent. Starting very well. Well, Kate's thrown it to you for a moment in a magnificent deflection.
Can't remember what the question was. Now it's too loud.
Let's go back to basics. What's your starting point for a novel? At what point do you know you've got a story to tell?
Oh, well, you look at... every novel is different, of course, but you always look for a subject that first and foremost is interesting to yourself. And so I have a lot of recurring themes, as I'm sure does every writer, because those are subjects that particularly interest you. The only book that's ever been particularly inspired for me about some sort of environmental catastrophe was when I was flipping through the newspaper one day, the Good Weekend, I think it was, and they had an article about the people that search for the Tasmanian tigers. And I thought, isn't it amazing how we persist in, despite all evidence to the contrary, some people just persist in... Well, really, we hope that what has happened hasn't actually happened, that there just might be one of them out there, and how we just don't want to believe this truth about ourselves, that we could do something like this, and that something has been so lost and so damaged and so stupid, that we're such a stupid species. And that was the idea behind The Stripes of the Sidestep Wolf, that if indeed we did find a Tasmanian tiger, what would happen then?
So if that idea is fueling you to write, surely that's a fairly political idea, not to be reductive, but surely there's a message you're trying to get across to your readers.
Sure, it is, but I've written like 19 novels, and really that's the only one that springs to mind as being politically motivated in that to that degree. The rest of them aren't. I mean, like Stephen said, in the end you just you do this because if you didn't write novels, you would be out painting lines on the road. And this is the only way that you can contribute to society. This is the best way we can contribute to society, not the only way. But I think people expect an awful lot of writers, like some sort of... they always expect wisdom, they always expect answers. And you just go, I am just somebody who puts a word and a word and a word. Why on earth would any of us know anything more than anybody else out there?
I might throw the same question that I've just thrown to you, I'm going to throw to Kate in terms that she can't deflect to someone else. Your last two novels have been historical novels, and notably, when you talked about the writing of The Secret River, you talked about partly being inspired by the walk across Sydney Harbour Bridge for Sorry Day, and about suddenly coming to an understanding you hadn't previously had and feeling a burning urge to go away and write about it. How is that not a political motivation for writing a novel?
Maybe there's a difference between having a political idea and having a question, because I think I write out of something I don't quite understand, a question about me in relation to the world, I suppose, something that doesn't add up. And in the case of The Secret River and the walk across the bridge for reconciliation, it was me realising that my family story that I knew from my mother about my convict ancestor directly impacted in a way that I was uncomfortable with what I was doing at that moment. My ancestor was a convict, he was freed, he went and, as the family story had it, took up land on the Hawkesbury River outside of Sydney. And I had never stopped to question what that took up land involved until that day on the Harbour Bridge. So it wasn't that I then decided to write a book about, with a specific idea. It was an area of puzzlement, of huge anxiety, unease, and it was something about my own relationship to the larger question. So it was, again, very narcissistic, which I guess is what we're all saying. Narcissistic is perhaps not a good word for it, but basically the thing is we are citizens too, as Shane said. The preoccupations and questions that we have are likely by their very nature to be questions that we all as a society share. And it's like when people ask you, you know, do you consider yourself a female writer or a woman writer, like as a genre? Well, of course I'm a woman writer. My whole experience is flavoured by the fact that I'm a woman. But that's between the lines. It's not what I set out to do.
I might, on the back of that excellent answer from Kate, for those who didn't get a chance to see Kate's keynote address last night on this topic and kind of teasing out some of the ideas we're talking about today, the university will be making all materials from throughout the festival available, and you can go and catch it online, and I heartily recommend it. I also heartily recommend her 12 books. I had to double check that, but it is 12 books now. She's a wonderful writer. She's won many awards, and she's going to give us a reading from her most recent novel, The Lieutenant. So please give a big round of applause to Kate.
Thank you very much. The Lieutenant is a historical novel, and if I had to answer that question about why write historical novels, it's partly because when you have that question about yourself in the present, it's too close. You can't quite see it. And if you set it at another place or another time, it's much easier to get a bit of a perspective on it. So the two historical novels that I've just written are deeply about today, but somehow it's easier to write about them by kind of triangulating, like those telescopes, you know, where the light bounces off the mirror and does various things. You're not looking at it directly, and you can actually see more sometimes by looking at it sort of sideways. The Lieutenant is about a young man who came out with the First Fleet, and he befriends a young Aboriginal girl, and she teaches him her language. And at the end of the book, he's confronted with a huge moral dilemma. He's sent out on an expedition whose purpose is to actually massacre some Aboriginal people who are probably, in fact, related to this young girl. And he has this moment, he's a soldier, I don't know if I said that, so he has this impossible dilemma. If he refuses the order, his entire life, career, livelihood, etc., his I'm sorry, I can't think of a polite word. He's stuffed, basically, for the rest of his life in his own society. On the other hand, if he obeys this order, he loses the thing that has become the most precious and important thing to him, which is this burgeoning sense of connection with not just this one Aboriginal girl called Tuggeran, but the whole world that she comes from. So this is the moment when he has to decide what to do. And I've chose to read this because it's a moment at which, as you'll see, he's confronted with something which reason cannot help him. The debate as to what to do, if he tries to work it out rationally, is exactly evenly balanced, as rational debates tend to be. What enables him to make a decision is some other thing altogether, something, if you like, intuitive. It's connected with nature. It's connected with, you know, what James Lovelock calls Gaia. And it's also a way of thinking that I think not just art, but also nature gives us this way of... In fact, Flaubert said the job of art is like nature, to set us to dreaming. And I think this little bit is my attempt to show that. He's on the sand at Botany Bay, and it's nighttime. He took a few steps down the dune and sat on the sand. On the glassy water, the moon was broken up into a patch of separate shifting points of sharp light, as white against the black as a magnesium flare. The surface seemed still, and yet small waves slid up the beach, then drew back with a hiss, leaving the lace edge of a different darkness on the sand. If you looked out at the bay, the specks of moonlight sliding across it, you would have said that it was as still as the water in a cup. Yet here it was at the edge, moving up and down, in and out, never at rest. He could see it now as he had never seen it before. One body of water encircling the globe. The continents, nothing more than insignificant obstacles around which it effortlessly flowed. The land, much less the people on it, was irrelevant to this enormous breathing being. It was divided up on the map, its parts given different names, but the names were not just irrelevant, but false. It was all one. Every drop acting separately and yet together with all its fellows, swelling and sinking in accordance with that plate of yellow light in the sky. A soft shawl of cloud had come from nowhere, teased out along the leading edge like carded wool. It slipped over the moon that could be seen travelling through it like a bright eye. He smoothed his hands over a patch of sand, feeling its silky coolness, the last flicker of warmth on its surface. The moon was bright, but he could see Sirius, that gem of the summer sky. The natives would have a name for Sirius. For them, it would not be part of the great dog. They would have some other story altogether. But whatever you called the stars, their light and their patterns were the same. Beyond the chatter of human argument was their plain statement. Everything is part of every other thing, now and forever. There was no debating with them. Logic was irrelevant to them. They were blissfully indifferent to the dilemmas faced by Lieutenant Daniel Rook, that speck of consciousness. By the timeless light of the heavens, his flicker of life meant no more than one of those sparks that flew up from the fire. Rook watched the uncoiling of the water, in and out, as each wave curled over itself and fell on the sand. A gleam of light streamed along its broken edge. Directly ahead of him was the gap in the land, beyond which was the ocean that had brought the white men 2 years before. He had stared from Sirius at the land approaching and seen nothing but opportunity. At Sydney Cove, he had watched those natives running along the shore, keeping pace with the boat, shouting their unambiguous message, "Go away." They had been nothing more than naked strangers. That Daniel Rook seemed to have been replaced, syllable, by some other man. He knew those naked people now. He did not understand them, but he could no longer think of them as strangers. There was no word for what he had learned with Tuggeran. He could not attach a name to what he felt for her, but she had shown him the existence of the man that he could be. It was not thought, not logic, not calculation. It was just an impulse of the body, like breathing or blinking, a reflex that was beyond reason. "I cannot be part of this," he said aloud. The words left behind a windy, hollow feeling that he recognised as fear. He did not know what difficult path this new Daniel Rook might take him down or where it would end. He knew only that he was prepared to welcome the stranger and follow where he led. Thanks.
That was beautiful, Kate. And you spoke very compellingly last night about the power of art to do exactly what's happening to Rook in that passage, to change a person, to get in and change the way they view the world, change the way they view themselves. That seems to me to go beyond just the writer as citizen who can affect change.
Yes. Look, I've been thinking a lot about this, as I suppose we all have on this panel. I mean, you know, should we be all rushing out to write books about, you know, as I said last night, the great coal is too cheap novel, which is what we need to save the planet? And I've decided in my amateur way that there are actually at least two kinds of ways of deciding how to act or how to change. And one is that whole rational debating, you know, figuring out parts per million and all the rest of it. But the other is what art does and what nature does, which is where something comes in and shocks open something in us which all that debate has closed. You know, there is a thing about that oppositional debating, that it actually has the effect of closing down the mind. It's the great problem with our oppositional ways of doing things, including Parliament. There's no third way. It seems to me that art offers that third way, which simply makes a crack in that wall of defensiveness into which other things like change, like new ideas, acceptance, admitting that we're wrong, can then flow. And that seems to me, which means we should all just go on writing what we write, but, you know, with enough passion to punch through people's kind of, including our own, complacency about all this.
Stephen, you were nodding along with that?
I just have that confidence that any kind of writing is... I've never had a sense of an audience anyway, not until, you know, sort of recently, you know. So I've always, you know, apparently, Laura Clancy tells me that apparently Nabokov said when he was asked, who does he write for? He said, I write for an audience of Nabokovs, you know. Now, and to an extent, that's what you do. You know, you write for yourself and you write for the like-minded. So, and I've never really had any great sense of an audience or any sort of great sense of the power of writing at all. And so I'd like to have the confidence to think that it can make some sort of an impact. But I'm not quite sure I've got it, really.
But there must be books that you can remember. Pardon me, jumping in.
I was actually going to go on and say that, yeah.
Right. Mm.
Yeah, but what I think...
Difference to you.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I think what actually happens in fiction, and there's something very special about the novel. You know, Terry Eagleton calls it, you know, a mongrel of a medium, and he's right, it's voracious. It takes from everywhere and it uses whatever it wants. You know. And what it triumphantly did too was actually bring ordinary people into an artistic enterprise and put them centre stage for the first time in history, long before they ever made their entrance on the political stage in terms of having the vote. So there is something about the novel that works like that anyway in a political sense. But as readers too, what the novel does is it makes us empathise if it's working and if we're responding to it and if there is that conjunction operating between writer and reader. It makes us empathise with somebody else from somewhere else that we've never actually met and possibly never will meet. And that is a significant thing. That's an important aspect to reading. And whether you call that political or not, I don't know. I don't call it political, but I call it significant.
That personal change is significant. Okay, so the four of you as readers, can you think of examples of books that have changed your worldview or at least shaken it? Sonia?
Look, I can't, but I do think it's important to point out that I think the books that really change us are the books we read when we're young. So I do think that writing for children has a responsibility in this day and age to, much more so than writing for adults that are already out there, are already driving, are already breeding way out of control and everything. The only way that you can really, I think, the best that fiction can do is to aim for kids now and say, your parents and your grandparents have done this, and this, and the only people that can really make a difference now are you young ones. And I certainly, when I write for kids, skew my books towards looking after the planet, looking after the trees, looking after the animals, and I think that that is an incredibly important, in fact, I've said before, I think that is the only important kind of writing left anymore in this world. I think that writing novels now is in a way, a kind of waste of time. I don't think that we need any more books in this world, not any more books for adults, but we certainly need books for children that will improve this planet, and that's the only way you're going to do it.
A panel of novelists have described themselves as self-indulgent, narcissistic, and now a waste of time. But I'll take this moment to say there's an excellent bookshop at the top of the stairs, and when we're done, you really must make your way up there and buy some more unnecessary books.
But actually it is. I mean, to ask of somebody who writes for adults to write a book, I mean, if I thought that writing a novel would fix up the world, I would go home right now and write a book about people who decide not to have any more children, who decide stop for burning coal, stop driving cars and all that. I'd write this book, I'd publish it, and the world would change. The fact is, it's not going to happen. It doesn't work that way. As Stephen said, you're preaching to the converted already.
In terms of that notion of preaching to the converted, I mean, Shane, the thought of you writing for a group of Maloneys scares me a little. But you flagged earlier that, you know, you find your books on the shelves of politicians around the country. There must be an incredible temptation, knowing they're readers of your books, to try and serve up to them some things you think they need to hear.
Yeah, well, obviously not paying any attention, you see. My intention is clearly quite so. Michael's keeping the ball moving here. I mean, he's moving around among us faster than St Kilda forward line at this stage. But I'm with Sonia on this. I mean, I think I can't really recall, just off the top of my head, books that have really blindsided me with a whole new way of seeing the world. But I can think of any number of books that have reinforced my way of thinking about the world, or perhaps expanded its parameters slightly. But certainly, you know, there are very few books that turn people around. And one of the problems I think about seeing a role for novels in all of this is that it's beyond the point of needing to persuade people. There are climate change. I mean, one of the what the government seems to me to be doing at the moment is not working on preventing climate change, but preventing the prevention of climate change. The problems and the solutions, to me, it seems, are so kind of evident now that it's clear that there are powerful interests that have dug their heels in and said, well, fuck yous, you know, for want of a better expression, excuse me. And that the problem is not persuading them to change their mind, because the minds are already decided. So, those people aren't going to read novels, no matter how, clever, persuasive, insidious, or however, that will adapt their way of thinking. They've made their minds up. They're going to do well out of it. They're going to survive. They're going to protect their interests. Okay, and they're going to use all of the resources at their disposal to ensure that opposition to climate change doesn't get anywhere. They've got their paid propagandists. They've got their unpaid propagandists. You know, do you think anybody who's ever visited, Andrew Bolt's blog
go on, you know, it's a dirty secret, but go on, haven't we? We've all had a bit of a look there. We've all had, you know, peered in. Do you think that the people who are, the hundreds and hundreds of people who write in their everyday are going to be persuaded by a well-written novel to change their point of view? You know, the armies of winged monkeys can be mobilised at a second's notice to shoot down, to block their ears to. Any arguments or any points of view or any perspectives that they don't want to listen to. And I think that it's in fact kind of moved beyond a cultural question.
So then why the novel? Why bother? Maybe Sonia's right. You're wasting your life, Shane.
Well, yeah. Look. Well, you said, clearly you said why do you write novels? Because if I wasn't writing novels, I'd be strangling people, and I've got a list. Would you like to? Would you like to come?
No, you're not.
I just thought you might like to give me a hand.
Yeah.
No. You're more productive than I am.
But I actually had the chance to run Andrew Bolt over one day. I was driving along Flinders Street, and he was making his way across to the old paper offices. And I looked up, and I thought, God, that's Andrew Bolt. And he wasn't too far away, and I was moving. The political animal in me said, plant the foot, get him, do the community a service.
The novelist thought, I can go to prison and I'll have a nice quiet room in which I can work.
Yeah, no, the novelist said, store this one up, but keep it as a potential.
I'm disturbed by the fact that the order of the day seems to be barely kept violence and nihilism, which is not a great combination. I am going to throw to you to give a reading, Stephen, because okay. Stephen Carroll's latest novel goes back to 1930s England, and it concerns itself with a great writer who has personally been responsible for a great deal of change. He's writing about T.S. Eliot. Now, Stephen has written novels set in recently historical Australia, contemporary Australia. He won the Miles Franklin Award for his novel before the most recent one. He's a wonderful writer. Please make him very welcome at the lecture.
I'll just briefly explain something about the background to the novel. It's all set. It's something I had in mind for about 20 years, but I was interrupted by a trilogy, which took about 10 years to write. So I eventually got around to it, and it's all set on the day that T.S. Eliot and his Boston sweetheart of 20 years before, Emily Hale, visited the estate of Burnt Norton in 1934. And it's a speculation on what might have taken place that day. Eliot is not a character in it. He's more a kind of presence, I suppose. He's a kind of literary imminence, if I can put it that way. And I made the decision not to actually try to get inside the mind of T.S. Eliot. I'm not quite sure I wanted to go there anyway. But I invented characters around him. This is what a novelist does. You know, we invent characters. And so I invented a young woman living in the village, which is actually Chipping Camden, and Chipping Camden is just about a mile. Burnt Norton. Burnt Norton's the first of the four quartets. I'm probably jumping ahead of myself here. But it's the first of the four quartets. It is a country estate. It's just outside of a village called Chipping Camden in Gloucestershire. In the Cotswolds. My approach was simply to view Eliot from the outside, to invent characters and indulge. Can you hear? Good. And indulge different ways of looking at Eliot. Now, two of those characters, they're young. One is called Catherine. She's an 18-year-old young woman living in the town. And the other one is Daniel. He's just back from university. He's a Marxist. So I could actually view Eliot, build up a kind of collage, if you like, by employing the different points of view that these characters have of the great Mr. Eliot. And I've lost my place. And I'm going to read a small section, which I thought was fairly apt for this topic, because it's such a vast topic, it's just my offering anyway. Catherine and Daniel are sitting on the lawns at Burnt Norton, and they're discussing writing just before Elliot and Emily Hale make their entrance into the Rose Garden, and they're looking down upon the Rose Garden, the very famous Rose Garden of Burnt Norton. They are a couple, and this is how they're described here. I'll just plunge into it, I think, rather than say anything more. And as much as the town might have suggested that they started hanging about together because she had no father and he had no mother, Daniel's mother had died with the flu when he was 10, and that they were united by private grief, the fact was they just liked the look of each other. Neither of them was dismissive of this or held it to be a superficial attraction. In time, they both agreed that the things that people like the look of tell you a lot about the people themselves. For they both had a certain kind of look, something out of kilter with the age. No fashionable clothes. For all his talk about the future, Daniel was strictly old world to look at, and she practically no makeup and possessing none of the graceful flowing dresses that actresses wore on the screen, off-the-rack imitations of which girls wore on Saturday nights to make themselves look like actresses. But it was more than that. They both projected a kind of conservatism, a social conservatism that masked the rebel in him and the hunger for life in her. It was no surprise to either of them that they agreed on many things, politics, books, the town, and just about everybody in it. And even when they disagreed, they were united by a shared passion to do so. The only books worth reading, he'd say, were the ones that shook the world up. By this he meant, of course, that books, poetry, novels, and yes, the bloody doddering theatre had to be political in some way. No, 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 she came back at him again and again. Too simple. A charge that Daniel took calmly and happily because he knew they were both on the same side. Poems, novels, stories, Catherine would say, and Daniel from the start admired a confidence beyond her years. Give people the lives they will never live and fill them with a yearning for something else, something more, a way of living in the world that doesn't yet exist. Doesn't yet exist, but dreaming about it just might make it so, and books that speak about these things just might make it so by inspiring people to go out there and create their lives, not have their lives imposed upon them. Isn't that shaking things up? Why do you think mothers and fathers and nuns snatch novels from the eager hands of girls of a certain age? Because they might get ideas, and we don't want that, do we? And why do you think fathers snort at the sight of their sons with their noses stuck in books? Because they might just get above themselves. And what was good enough for them and their father and their father's fathers, the mills of the mines, won't be good enough for their sons. And even though Daniel always felt there was just a bit too much of the rugged individual about all this, he still couldn't help but be swept up in a sheer enthusiasm. That and the sparkle in her eyes alight with argument and energy. And I'll stop there. And very quickly,
before you go on...
I'll quote the source. Rule number one, apparently, is never quote your sources. Well, novelists are a bit like anarchists, really. They not only break the rules, but they break the rules as a rule. And so I'm about to break the rules. I took that, and we take things, we're voracious, we're collectors. And I took it from a book of essays by Mario Vargas Llosa, The Temptation of the Impossible. It's about the novel. I can recommend it. It's a terrific collection of essays, and he talks about this sort of stuff. In fact, this is the section that I drew it from. He says, "It is the case that, albeit to a lesser extent, all fictions make their readers live the impossible, taking them out of themselves, breaking down barriers and making them share, by identifying with the characters of the illusion, a life that is richer, more intense or more abject and violent or simply different from the one that they are confined to by the high security prison that is real life. Fictions exist because of this fact, because we have only one life and our desires and fantasies legacies demand 1,000 lives, because the abyss between what we are and what we would like to be has to be bridged somehow. That was why fictions were born, so that through living this vicarious, transient, precarious, but also passionate and fascinating life that fiction transports us to, we can incorporate the impossible into the possible, and our existence can be both reality and unreality, history and fable, concrete life and marvellous adventure. Now, that... Thanks, Mr. Thanks, Vargas Llosa. Now, that is, in this vast topic, and it's an extraordinary topic, is my offering, in a sense. It's this, that the novel is intrinsically subversive. It shakes things up because it shakes us up. And in shaking us up, if it works on us, it makes us think about a life that is not yet in existence that could exist. And in that sense, it's not only an indulgent experience, a pleasurable experience, an aesthetic one, in that whole sense of aesthetic response, but it's also in that very unlikely way a subversive and, in a sense, a political medium as well. Thank you.
For those keeping score in their programs, we're an hour in to a session called In Defence of the Novel, and we've just had our first defence of the novel. So just chalk that one down, because there's lots more where that came from. That's interesting to me, Steve, because it does seem, you know, that's a very passionate defence of the novel.
Yes, I suppose it is. Yeah, and I'm ambivalent when I was talking with Kate just there, just before. You know, I was saying I don't actually have the confidence to believe that it can. But it works on me like that. And maybe if it works on me, it works on other people like that too. I mean, we're talking about reading experiences before. And I can remember very clearly a pivotal reading experience where the novel actually did change me. And it was by Somerset Maugham. It was a thing called The Razor's Edge. Up until I was about 18 or something, I'd never read a book because of... I was playing cricket or playing footy. I didn't give a toss about books. But I read this. I don't know how I came to read it. But it's a book about someone... It's almost a sort of a cliché sort of scenario, but it's a book about someone whose life is saved on the last couple of days of the First World War, and decides that life's got to be about more than just selling bonds or working for the man. And so he becomes a reader, and the book made me a reader. And in making me a reader also opened up all sorts of other possibilities and reading possibilities, and those possibilities will inevitably be political ones and social ones. Now, we are social beings and political beings. It's just that I do believe that we work best when we actually respond to the things that are vital and urgent in us. And if it's not urgent, forget it.
So... Let's kind of harness that feeling. Let's forget about climate change. Let's forget about cultural change. Let's focus on that experience of being a reader. Because I doubt there's anyone in this room who's here for any reason other than that they're a passionate reader and they love to engage with the things that they read. Is that the rest of your experience?
Yeah, well, certainly mine. I was at the poet's session this morning. I don't know if any of you were. It was remarkably contrasting with this, because poets... have probably even less of a foothold on, you know, changing the world than novelists have. And yet they were very upbeat. And, on the wrong panel here. Peter Minter made a very interesting distinction between writing that is a mode of encounter and writing that is a mode of inquiry. He actually had a much more sophisticated thing about science and conscience. He worked it all out in Greek and everything. But what I took away from that as a sort of reader was that what the novel can do, and I suppose poetry as well, is not to come up with answers. I mean, what we're predicating this on the notion that we as novelists should kind of descend from the mountain with the tablets of wisdom and kind of hand it over to the rest of you. It ain't like that. And I think that's where that feeling of diffidence that has been so marked in this panel comes from. We don't have answers. But what we do have is questions. And actually, maybe what the world needs at the moment is an openness to the fact that actually we don't know. We don't have the answers.
Let's go into the fact that we don't have the answers. Let's go into the questioning mode. And I have a feeling that's what the novel does. That's why it takes 300 pages. Mm. It's a very long, complicated, difficult to articulate question about human beings in one form or another. So, you know, we have to defend the novel here, and that's my defence of it.
I don't know. I can't help but think there's not one writer in the history of writing that wouldn't have been better off, wouldn't have contributed more to society with a bit of judicious strangling. Because really, I mean, even somebody like George Orwell, who, when I think of political writers, is, OK, at the top of the tree, has not made as big a change to the world as somebody like that loony who shot Lincoln. Just, you know, I think that books, no matter, there's always going to be, but we need to speak to 6 billion people. And yes, not just, and it's, I agree, Stephen, that a book can change somebody, but they can change somebody who's a young 18-year-old boy who's going to make a living out of becoming a writer. You were actually, at 18, the person that you are now. The book didn't change you, it just made you realise who you were already.
Thank you.
So I don't know, I have actually...
My time's up, is it?
I have actually seriously found myself thinking in the last year, you would be better off, rather than writing another book, you'd be better off taking somebody out. You really would. It would be more important to this world to kill somebody than to write another book.
See, it's often overlooked about Orwell. That at least he went out with a rifle in his hand and shot in the general direction of some fascists. You know? At one point, he's like, you can see we're sitting here at home. They're at home working on our novels with these darker thoughts going on.
I don't know how this session descended into John Wilkes Booth versus George Orwell. And I'm shocked that Booth is winning.
The amazing thing is, though, that it would be the only time that somebody like me would make maybe the front of the paper, or the only time any of us would make the front of the paper, not because we've written some fantastic book, but because you've taken out, you know, somebody, you know, the boss of BHP or something.
Alongside the fact that you've wandered into In Defence of Homicide for a moment. Sonia, you were the one who was talking about the importance of getting young people reading and reading in order to shape and kind of affect their worldview. That seems at odds with what you're saying now.
Well, not necessarily.
And don't shoot me if I'm wrong.
I guess, you know, you wouldn't write in a children's book that it's the good way to live your... Although, really, I think... I think that somebody who would maybe... To really sacrifice your own life by taking out somebody who's very bad to have in society is a good way to live. It is. But, okay, so I would...
I would say it's certainly one of the satisfactions of writing crime novels that part of the requirement, the implicit contract with the reader, is that the bad guys get their comeuppance.
Yeah, which they don't in real life.
Which is not the way it really works, of course. You know.
And that's what novels are for, isn't it? So that we can do it vicariously.
Yeah, but who wants to do it vicariously? What's the point?
Because it means that instead of 6 million people going out and shooting people, nobody needs to, in fact.
But sometimes...
Steve? Oh, just the example. I mean, I get thrown about... from side to side. You know, it's not a contradiction, it's a paradox.
Come
you know?
To my side.
Yeah, I was there for a while. I'm leaving it.
Is it because of me? Once the shooting starts, it's how do you stop it?
There's a famous Auden quote, that poetry makes nothing happen. You know, and I think there's a lot of complacency about that, considering he was a Marxist and he was trying to make things happen. But you know, his poetry, in his view, made nothing happen. But there is the example of Havel, you know. I mean, there's a guy who eventually became president of the country in which he'd spent most of his time in jail, you know. And he chose to write
as apart from shoot someone.
Because he was in jail. What else could he do?
But even before he went to jail, he wasn't shooting people. He was writing. So, you know, to an extent, I think we are actually underplayed,
exception to the rule, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, though.
Can I try and... Who do you shoot? I mean, we go out and shoot them today. Who do you shoot?
There's time for who would you shoot in question time, so we might... if I can try and salvage some of this insanity for a moment.
Where to begin, Kate?
Of what you're talking about, part of what's kind of fun about this kind of talk is a question of escapism. And Shane's pointed towards the fact that he's used the term pulp fiction for what you write. Shane, you, I suspect, you're producing art, but you're also producing... means of escapism for your readers. How does that fit in with this? Is it
you accusing me of art?
Only by accident.
Yes, I assure you, it's inadvertent. I was looking for something to read from my work, actually, that in any way might have been pertinent to the topic. But the only thing I could find was a scene in the most recent novel where Murray Whelan fails to get his Y2K compliance paperwork in on time, resulting, of course, in a catastrophic falling of planes from the sky at the stroke of midnight, December 1999. I think that the escapist element is certainly, you know, is there. I mean, one of the reasons that we read is to escape. It's, you know, it's a place that we can go. It's a great way of being alone and being able to. You have a perfectly reasonable excuse for not doing anything else. I'm reading. Sounds like I'm taking the sacrament or something, doesn't it? You know, and so within that kind of, you know, within that framework, I think the opportunities for clearly we have difficulty here distinguishing ourselves in a sense just from general entertainers, in a way. But I'll take up what Steve was talking about there with the role of novel. But however kind of grand a narrative is, essentially the task of the novel or the focus of the novel or the centre of the novel is the individual. And at this particular stage, there are many, many kind of individual forms of action and individual responses that we're called on to take in the present situation. So by valuing the individual, making the individual the focus of our work, I think that we are, in fact, you know, really upholding, not just upholding a tradition, but potentially serving a very, very kind of worthwhile purpose.
In terms of writing about the individual, then, and that question of writing about humanity and kind of trying to capture that, both Steve and Kate, your latest books do centre around real-life figures and the way in which you've kind of chosen to recreate them as fictional creations. I might throw to you first, Kate, because it's something that obviously has come up in the past in commentary about the kind of fraught area of writing historical fiction. I don't want to take you back there again.
Not again.
Necessarily, but it seems there's something interesting there about what rights the writer of fiction has, not just what responsibilities, but whether they have a right to tell history and call it history in any way.
Well, it's even larger than that. It's, what right do we have to... Well, yes, in my case, I mean, to background this, for those who might have been on Mars for the last couple of years and not realised what trouble I've been getting into from historians... there has been a lot of kerfuffle about both of these books, but particularly The Secret River. A sense that I've been... I mean, the words used are words like, she's hijacking history, she's appropriating history. Now, I actually can't get a handle on what that argument is about. I have tried, but clearly behind it, underneath it, swims some deep, deep anxiety. And I think it's the anxiety of... a book that does raise a lot of uncomfortable issues and uncomfortable questions. In fact, a history that raises uncomfortable questions. It's a whole lot easier to be able to wrap it up in some neat little parcel and kind of put it on the shelf marked history and forget about it. The problem with historical novels, those of us who write them, is that suddenly that history cannot be apartheided up on the shelf there. It's suddenly a living part of our contemporary life, and that's deeply, deeply uncomfortable. Which, of course, is a kind of backhanded tribute to the power of the novel. I mean, here we are saying it does nothing.
We're coming round.
They wouldn't be attacking us if it was doing
that's
nothing.
That's right, if it wasn't actually getting up their noses, they wouldn't be going for us, would they?
That's right.
And, of course, this is what the novel does that history writing can't do. And we've got respect for historians, you know, we've got a history degree, for Christ's sake, you know. I have respect for what has happened, but at the same time, I'm a novelist. And what a novelist can do that an historian can't do with a lot more sense of freedom is actually explore the possibilities of an historical circumstance in a way that only the more speculative historians can do. It comes down to in the end, to what do you want to do? Do you want to write something that people will say, oh, well, no, that's a pretty kind of reasonable representation of what I thought, you know, such and such a time and place might have been? Or do you want to put a rocket under them, you know? And that's what I want to do. I want to put a rocket under people, you know? And I'm writing a book at the moment which goes back to the... to 1946. It's a sort of prequel to the trilogy, the Glenroy sequence of books. And I've got a journalist in there who's meeting an old farmer called Skinner. And I thought I've got him actually reflecting on this character of Skinner and how certain names die out and he's it's a name like sort of, you know, Shoreditch or Rudge or something like that. Those names you don't see anymore. And after I'd finished writing the passage, because I felt like writing it, it felt like it was there to be written, I thought I'd better check out in the Skinners, you know. So I went to the phone directory, and I can't tell you, Michael, how disappointed I was to discover how many Skinners there were continuing to exist.
I hope you didn't let that get in the way of a good story.
No, it didn't. Oh, well, I was cheered by the thought that, you know, they might all be 95, you know, so the Skinners might yet come good. But eventually the choice was, what am I going to be true to, the telephone directory or my imagination? So I chose my imagination and my novel.
Choice.
the much-quoted Picasso line that art is the lie that shows us the truth seems useful here.
Mm-hmm.
Why fiction? Back to that again. Why not, you know, you quote the Vargas Llosa, Stephen, and then you compare that to your own work where you bring it alive in fiction. Shane, I would much rather read a new Murray Whelan book than another newspaper article about Brimbank Council, even if they deal with exactly the same material. Why? What's the potency? What's the potency of fiction?
One is fun and one is not.
Yes. You'll just have to read my upcoming biography of Justin Madden. I suppose I am to some extent... well, I don't know. I mean, it is more entertaining because, as Steve so correctly points out, you're able to shape the material to your purposes. You know, true crime doesn't interest me at all, apart from the fact that it's ghastly. Its perpetrators are often extraordinarily dull people, apart from occasional flashes of violence, and you only have to read the transcripts of police phone taps to realise how banal the dialogue is. certainly I think that that fiction is attractive to us because it gives a shape and a form and a narrative and a thread, and you do want to know what happens next. I mean, I think, unfortunately, in terms of this big picture, just drawing it back to climate change, we have a fair sneaking suspicion that we know what's going to happen next. And so the question here is not, can we second guess the author, but a different question entirely, which may not be evidently beyond, which is evidently beyond our powers to sort of adequately, you know, synthesise.
The last of our readings today comes from Sonia Hartnett, and if you want a better defence of the novel, you could do a lot worse than to read any of the books by our novelists on the panel today. But Sonia demonstrates in every one of her books the way in which a paragraph is more powerful than a bullet. Her most recent book is Butterfly, but I think she's reading from an earlier one today. Please make her very welcome to the lecture.
Thank you, Michael. I don't know, you won't convince me though. I really do think that my days as a writer are done and my days as a homicidal maniac soon to begin.
Give that girl an AK-47.
Plus, who would suspect me? I mean, you know.
There's a room of several hundred people here.
Okay, this is a little bit from The Ghost Child, which was my second last book. It's written with a very sort of light touch, and people have called it a fable, which is a word I'm not fond of, but that might explain why the language is kind of simple. It's about a book about an old woman, Maddie, who comes home from walking her dog one day and finds a boy sitting in her lounge room, and she tells him the story of her life. And this is a bit where Maddie is 17, and her father takes her around on a trip around the world in search of the world's most beautiful thing. Papa had planned an itinerary which took the pair of them circling the globe. Quickly, they settled into a routine. They would disembark in an exotic city on the edge of a continent, find transport in the form of a carriage or train, hire a guide who was familiar with the language and sights. And then they would begin their search, crisscrossing the land, hunting out treasures, poring over maps, arguing and discussing and comparing the merits of the spectacles which stood before them. Maddie had bought a journal, the biggest and thickest she could find. Nonetheless, she had to make her writing tiny, her sketches miniatures, to squeeze in all her meditations on the wonders she saw. On their mission to discover the world's most beautiful thing, she and her father visited cathedrals as tall as Alps and stood in reverence beneath painted domes capping heaven above their heads. They saw mosques and temples and ivory-tangled graveyards, took side trips to deserts to see colossal Buddhas hewn from mountainsides, and to soundless monasteries in the middle of nowhere to kneel before relics of saints. They strolled down the gilded halls of palaces and castles, climbed the stone steps of turreted towers, felt the mist of fountains and orange groves. Stained glass windows in time-honored university halls smudged them with blurs of light. They walked in circles through mighty libraries, humbled by how much there was to know. They attended plays and symphonies and readings of poetry. Each evening they ate a foreign meal, and each night they slept like the dead. To Maddie's surprise, her father made an excellent touring companion. She had expected him to be supercilious or disparaging, but it seemed that the Iron Man had stayed at home. In his place stood a man Maddie did not know, someone adventurous and appreciative and patient. At first, Maddie couldn't think what to say to him, for they were strangers. But as the weeks and months passed, they became one another's closest friend, sharing the same memories, knowing things about each other that none but the other knew. Maddie had always respected her father, but now she decided she loved him too. Loving him made her feel merry and wishfully sad. She didn't want their journey to end. She wanted to keep her adventurous papa forever. She could not bear the thought of going home and seeing him stiffen into the stern and preoccupied Iron Man. She would feel robbed and deserted. Lying on a narrow bed in her compartment of a train, the metal wheel screeching on the icy tracks as a gale howled across the tundra outside, Maddie shut her new preferred father inside the prison of her heart, from where he could not escape. She would never stop loving him. She would never doubt his love for her. He might age, alter, spoil, disappear. But for Maddie, he would always be this happy-go-lucky travelling man, changeless on his pedestal, preserved like a flower pressed inside a thick book. Together they visited scientific laboratories and peered into microscopes to see a drop of blood made monstrous. At planetariums, they looked through gigantic telescopes at pinpoint planets and stars. They meandered the length of galleries and museums and acres of botanic gardens, reading aloud from the plaques which accompanied each masterpiece and fossil and shrub. In glass houses, they inspected fungi and ferns and sniffed prize-winning blooms. They drank from goblets in the shade of kasbahs and spent afternoons in extravagant bazaars unrolling rugs which had taken decades to weave. They visited kilns to gaze into bulbs of molten glass. They climbed to the point of a pyramid and breathed at the summit the dust of millenniums. At the edge of an archaeological dig, they witnessed the unearthing of a pharaoh entombed for thousands of years. Maddie imagined his royal spirit disturbed, winging like a dark bat into the sky. For her 17th birthday, her father gave her a smooth brass kaleidoscope. Maddie, squinting down its length, saw chips of colour swimming in remarkable patterns. She sat on a palazzo balcony in a city built on a sea, woozy with the richness of the wonders she'd seen. She felt such admiration for humankind's artistry and nature's glory that she was frequently speechless and close to tears. The whole world was a ravishing marvel. There was nothing that wasn't fabulous to her. The cracks between cobbles, the coldness of ice, the greenness of apples, the squeak of soldiers' boots. When the diggers uncovered his time-lost face, Maddie had thought the desiccated, eyeless, mummified pharaoh exquisite enough to rival the bluest lake. Thank you.
There's an extent to which the topic for this session is utterly facile. For me as a reader, the novel is its own defence. That I know as a reader when I feel a novel has been successful, when it moves me, when it amuses me, when it makes me think, when it carries me along and I get to the end and I'm disappointed and want to start all over again. You know, that as a reader, I know when a novel has worked for me. As writers, when do you feel like... When are you happy with your work? When do you feel you've been successful in the enterprise of being a novelist? I might start with you, Sonia.
Well, just reading that bit there, I remember sitting in front of my heater at home making the list of things that Maddie and her father were going to see. And it was a great long list. That passage goes on a lot further than that. It talks about animals and rah-de-rah-de-rah. But the only bit I thought was really worth writing down is when they see the Buddhas that have been hewn from the mountainside. And it was not long after the Taliban had blown up those two Buddhas. And I thought that is that single few words that they visited Buddhas hewn from mountainsides are the most important four words I've ever written, really. When a book can show you what you have lost or what you are in danger of losing, that's when a book is doing its work. That's what a book has to do, I think. If there's any point to a book at all, it has to say stop and look at what is around you and stop and look at what you have and what you might not have and what you can learn and what you don't yet know. And a book should be a sort of painless education.
Steve, your novel before last was called The Time We Have Taken. That's the same kind of note of melancholy, that recognition of what might not be anymore and what it means to us now. Do you share that?
I think to an extent that's my temperament. I'm sort of one of those Edwardian, psychologically, one of those Edwardian individuals, you know, one of those people for whom, you know, the sun is always setting in the shadows long across the green playing fields of a rapidly fading era. I mean, that is me, you know. It doesn't mean I'm an unhappy person. I am.
I'm withdrawing my offer. I suppose,
you know, as I think something, just to risk of repeating myself, I think That sense of change and moving on, I think lots of ways, psychologically, it's all linked up to mortality, isn't it? You know, there's sort of, you know, the inevitability of the big moments, you know, and that I suppose will be manifest in the writing in a sense, the way we look at the society, the way we depict society. I can't explain why there is a constant sort of sense of leaving something behind in all of those books, in all of those Glenroy books, apart from saying that it's just me. That's the beauty of the novel, really, is that it takes you inside somebody's head and it gives you entree to somebody else's head. And what you get from it is what this other person, whom in most cases you will never meet, how this person experiences life. And if it does that, and if there are things that connect with you when you read, then I suppose it's done its purpose. But when do you know when you're actually having a great time? The Glenroy novels for me were kind of hard work. But doing this one,
Glenroy
was hard work. Yeah, but this one, the Eliot one, you know, I don't mean this in the presumptuous sense at all. But you know, you have that feeling you go into a bookshop and you look around for a book to read and it's not there, and you think, well, one of the most wonderful writing experiences I've ever had at all was writing this book, The Lost Life, about Eliot, because I felt like I felt like I was writing the book that I couldn't find in the bookshop. And I don't mean to be presumptuous, but I felt like I was writer and reader at the same time. And it was just a sheer buzz from start to finish.
Kate, The Lieutenant is heartbreaking, ultimately, in its ability to look at something that was lost or missed, an opportunity for understanding, because it's such kind of old history now. It somehow makes it all the more kind of cogent. Are you done with history for now, or do you have more to write?
While ever they keep accusing me of hijacking history, I intend to go on writing it. Well, writing novels inspired by history. The thing that fascinates me about writing, I think the reason I keep on doing it, is to be surprised. If I know where it's headed, and this is why I could never write a book about climate change, or a book of kind of preaching, or a book to sort of, you know, make young people see the world differently. I would know where it was going. And as writers, we have to be in the position of readers, being drawn along that thread of not knowing. That's what, I mean, and it, a novel is a big piece of work. You need a powerful engine to get you going to the desk every day. And curiosity is the best engine there is. So that if I write a paragraph and I think, wow, where did that come from? That's, for me, the moment, which is not really to answer your question, except to say that I find when I go back and read history, it's full of those moments. Wow, what happened there? Who were those people? How did that come about? I mean, the notion that a young soldier should befriend a 12-year-old Aboriginal girl and that they should leave a record of their conversations is so unlikely. You know, who were these two remarkable people? So, you know, to go into the unknown, question in hand, that's my idea of happiness.
Shane, having so effectively kind of captured the Kane era with Stiff, the very first Murray Whelan book, the last one left him going federal just at the dawn of the Howard years. How can that not feel like a grand project skewering that one individual on the page? That's a question. There was a question.
Okay. All right. Do you know the answer as well?
All right. I'll ask you a different question.
Yeah.
And then you can answer whatever question you like.
Can I pick of the board?
Yeah, whatever you like. But my different question is, you've spoken in interviews about the next Murray Whelan book being the final Murray Whelan book. Is that... Do you anticipate closure as a writer? Is there a grand narrative you're telling? Or will you never be satisfied?
Well, with this particular series of books, I simply feel that I can't... This character, Murray Whelan, that I've created, who appears to have an independent life of his own... At one point, he was sending me money in the mail, but... He is a federal MP entering Parliament at the dawn of the Howard era. The book I'm working on, number 7 at the moment, is set in what I think is a particularly dark period in our history, and it is quite difficult to mine it for laughs. which is essentially what my enterprise is. I must say that my fellow novelists here, I just have such admiration for so much of what they write when I see not so much the seriousness of their intent, but the results that they achieve in summoning up particular moments and moods and feelings. The Secret River, I was frozen cold for the first, you know, half of that. That poor fellow in London, I mean, his aching feet, you know, how you did that was just marvellous. And, I'm a low comedian who writes crime, you know, I mean. So the standards that I set myself can be fairly low. However, for me, the question you asked, how do you know of Sonia and the others? You know, what do you get out of it? How do you know, sort of when you're finished? Is for me, it's a sense of a well-made object, essentially. That no matter how kind of humble the artifact that it is that I'm trying to create, for me, the satisfaction is in knowing that I have made it as good as I can within the limits of my power as a writer, and the way I judge its success in the outside world is that if I see someone on a bus who's reading it while having their lunch, if their milkshake comes out their nose, then I have, I can take some pride in that moment.
That's a time-honoured literary tradition with that particular measurement. Now, we are going to have time for a couple of questions, but before we throw to them, I'd just like to ask you to join me in thanking our four novelists, Sonia Hartman, Steve Carroll, Kate Gremlich, Shane Maloney.
I'm moving to here in an attempt to be a little more imposing, because when it comes to questions, I have two rules. The first is that any question you ask has to be shorter than any possible answer it could receive. If it's not, you've failed, and we'll just take the microphone away from you. The second one is it must have a question mark at the end of it. I know that can be confusing, but don't open it with the words, I guess this is more of a statement, because we're not particularly interested in that either. But there is no better defence of the novel, I'll say one more time, than its diversity and the fact that novel writing is a very broad church. We have four practitioners at the absolute top of their game who all do very different work and all equally compelling and moving and wonderful. So I do urge you again to get up to the bookshop at the end of the session. But now there are microphones, so you're going to have to be patient because it only takes about half an hour to get them to people. Here we go. There's one over here.
Well, thanks for all of those exciting talks. I just think the panel were amazingly coy in their admitting their political, political dimension of what they write. I think all of us agree that there's sort of not a one-to-one relationship between art and politics or ethics, but I just want to suggest that in years to come, their work will all be reveal itself in its political dimension very accurately. And I, in terms of climate change, it just struck me that nothing. This is the question. Surely the very beautiful reading by Kate was we could have no greater hymn to nature, to the importance of water, and to living in harmony than the piece that Kate read out today is a very revealing commentary on climate change.
Now, that is a lovely tribute to our writers, and I'm grateful for it.
A question to Kate.
Not yet. But almost. If I could paraphrase for those at the back who are making their way to the door, don't you all feel that love of being readers, and we'll start with you, Kate, that's as compelling a statement as we can make. You talk about writers as citizens, as human beings. Surely sharing some of that experience that so moves people is justification enough?
It is absolutely brilliant. I mean, you write the stuff that you just about chuck out because you think it's so terrible in your room, and then, you know, when it sees the light of day with all its faults, and people, as I said last night, everybody reads it through the filter of their own experiences and prejudices. You've remade what I read. Everybody in the room heard something slightly different, and that's brilliant. It belongs to you now, so that it's terrific. Thank you.
I'm going to rephrase your question again. I'm also going to rethink my notion of what makes me look intimidating. Because it's clearly not what it could be. Now, if I do this... I'm going to paraphrase a question here. How did you all feel when asked to talk about climate change, given none of you have directly written about the subject? Sonia?
Again, it just made me think again that writers are expected to be a lot smarter than everybody else, and I so am not. And you get up here and you just think, oh God, I'm a fraud and an idiot. And it's just, I think, unfortunate that you choose a particular career and people think you're, you know, much more than you are simply because you can string a couple of words together. But I don't know, I think in my case, it's an opportunity lost. You know, I wish there was somebody a hell of a lot smarter than me sitting here who was able to give you the answers that people seek.
I'm going to throw to another question now. I use the word another advisedly. Yep, just here.
Okay, I'll try and make mine quick. I'm actually an engineer, and I came on Wednesday and heard a lot of architects talk, and I suppose what they were talking about was vision. And none of you write science fiction, and I don't know if you hang out with anyone who does, but I suppose in terms of climate change, what people are looking for is a vision. And do you think that the novel can provide that?
Shane, many aspects of your personal life could be described as science fiction. Do you want to?
No, that's a really good question. That is a really good question because, I spoke briefly before about the kind of apocalyptic visions that arose out of the possibility of nuclear exchange, which, by the way, haven't gone away. Those possibilities remain. I think, you know, to climate change we can add now an enhanced and increased possibility of nuclear war. And for the most part, novelists and then spinning out of that filmmakers found science fiction to be a way of addressing that issue through the whole kind of bomb culture period of the 50s, 60s and 70s. And I think it's really interesting now that we are beginning to see these kind of this issue dealt with, this kind of, you know, power, apocalyptic kind of notion being dealt with. It's particularly kind of in film at the moment. And I'm really not sure whether or not the novel has quite kind of found its footing on this in a general sense. It's not my turf, but in a general sense, I don't know whether the novel has quite found a kind of purchase on this. But it's fantastic to see the way some filmmakers are going about it. And clearly somebody's writing a script for them, so...
A couple of people in the question session for Kate's lecture last night mentioned a debut novel by a Melbourne writer called Stephen Amsterdam called Things We Didn't See Coming, that very much is set in a kind of post-nebulous, post-climate change world, and it's a terrific example that is worth repeating for any of you looking for something along those lines. Room for another question, and I'm going to need someone with a microphone over this side of the room.
Hi. Hello. I have 7 grandchildren. I read assiduously all my life. Not one of my bloody grandkids reads, and they go from 4 to 20. I pretend I write a little. How come you novelists, the professional people, get young kids to start reading. Everything is so quick. Quick grabs, quick bites. You've got quick climate change, cultural change. How can you people help us get our kids to read?
Stop encouraging them. Tell them it's forbidden.
And you can buy Shane's parenting manual up in the bookshop as well.
See, this is, I mean, as somebody who does write for children, you get this all the time. How can I make your children read? Your children are your children. They're not my children. I do my job as well as I can do my job. I write what I hope are beautiful, interesting books. For a start, I also don't think that every child has to read. Why should they? I didn't play sport. What difference does it make? If one kid doesn't read, it's not going to be the end of the world. But it's the job of teachers and librarians and parents and grandparents and other people to make a child read or to encourage them to read. It's not the job of the writer. The writer just provides the material. I think that that is enough for the writer to do and to do it to the best of their abilities. If you want your grandkids to read, find a way to make them. I don't know them. And me grabbing the little things and shaking them and going, read, read, bang, bang, it's not going to help. So I just don't think it's a writer's job to make a kid read. And also, I don't think it's a crime if a kid doesn't.
I'll say as an extension of that, the other thing that we need to do is bolster our local publishing industry and make sure that our authors' books are available and that our authors are getting properly remunerated for it. And at a time when the Productivity Commission has under siege local writers, these four wonderful writers, their extensive backlists would not be anywhere near as viable were we to get rid of territorial copyright. And so that's one thing we can do. We can support our local industry and keep it vibrant and diverse and alive. One last question, because I was waffling. And bad luck, I've got the microphone just here.
Thank you. Earlier, Sonia mentioned that to change things or to take a strong stance in interesting times, a novel need to speak to 6 million readers. But perhaps it could just be one reader with an extraordinary mind that needs that vision or that question to go out and make the change that they make.
Yes, you can be lucky and get that one, you know, that one Obama or that one...
Say, Kevin Rudd, go on, I dare you.
It didn't even occur to me, I have to tell you. But again, that's sort of like, it's a bit of a chicken the egg situation, like with Stephen, that my point is that you're already talking to somebody who has the potential to change the world anyway. But I guess what I feel is that it's asking a lot for somebody who's just typing a little story in their bedroom in West Preston to come up with that sort of, you know, to try to project yourself forward to that sort of thing, that you might speak to somebody who could change the world. That would be nice, but you might have noticed I'm fairly cynical and I just don't know that could happen. But it's the best that you could ask for, I guess. It's the best that you could hope for.
The rest of you, do you have an ideal reader in mind? That one reader who you hope your book breaks through to? Or is it just another Carol, another Grenville, another Maloney?
I don't know about that. Yeah. No, sorry.
Well, I have a feeling it might be. I mean, because I write out of a question, it really is me talking to me. But I also think I'm an ordinary, very ordinary person. And if it interests me, perhaps it will interest a few other people as well.
I always work on the assumption that that the reader is much, much smarter than I am. In which case, he or she has probably solved the problem of climate change. Just a matter of speaking up about it.
Well, I think the past week has shown us the capacity for everyone in this room and everyone who's attended the Festival of Ideas to be that one ideal reader and to make themselves smarter about the topics and the ideas. Do go to the bookshop, do buy copies of the author's books, because if you don't, you've heard from Sonia what she'll do. And none of us want that on our conscience. Please join me in thanking the four panelists. And as the final session of what I think you'll agree has been a wonderful festival, I'd ask you to join me in welcoming to the stage the director of the festival, Patrick McCagan.
Ladies and gentlemen, our revels now are ended, but I would be remiss if I did not thank three parties who have made this possible. First of all, the Festival of Ideas was an initiative of the Vice-Chancellor of this university, Glyn Davis, who's with us here today. And it just shows the benefits of having a real intellectual as the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. And I'd be remiss if we didn't thank him. The festival has been run with extraordinary efficiency, not by me, but by my deputy, Jaisal Shaw, who was not so much the nuts and bolts person. She fashioned the nuts, she cast the bolts, then she ordered the scaffolding, and then she put it together because it will be cheaper on her budget. But everything that has made the festival run efficiently, we owe to Jaisal Shaw, and I should like you I would commend her to you. But lastly, and this is the most important of all, you as an audience over the last week have been time and time again, when we have thrown it out to the audience, have really energised the sessions, shown a great capacity to enter into dialogue with the more than 50 speakers we've had this week. It is your presence, your responsiveness, your intelligence, which I think guarantees the future of another festival of ideas. So I thank you.